Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, Serialites, thanks for joining us this week. It's me, your old pal, Dan Grimshay, welcoming you to Saturday Morning Serial. This week, we are very proud to announce, and also very horrified to announce, it is the 30th, yes, gasp, 30th anniversary of the release of Top Gun in theaters. That's right, it's been 30 years since Maverick Goose and all his wacky friends got up to adventures high in the sky, and we, wow, are now 30 years older. But listen, you can't let that take away from the fact that this pop culture touchstone that captured the imagination of moviegoers around the world is celebrating its 30th anniversary as Top Gun arrives already on digital HD from Paramount Home Media Distribution, with loads of special features available digitally for the first time. This digital HD release also includes brand new interviews with Tom Cruise and producer Jerry Bruckheimer. And you might know him. He's still working a little bit, I think. It was all recorded back in 2016, this year, 30 years after Top Gun came out, in order to mark the anniversary. Relive the action-packed thrill ride and return to 1986 as Cruise and Bruckheimer share their memories of making the film and what it took to bring the story of an elite group of pilots competing to earn the title of Top Gun to the big screen. Hear the personal stories as they reminisce about the challenges they faced and share their thoughts on the film's enduring cultural impact. Plus, discover what might lie ahead for Maverick. Hint, hint, tease, tease. Top Gun was originally released May 16, 1986, and ultimately earned a worldwide box office of over $350 million, which is 1986 dollars, keep in mind, everybody. Tom Cruise is superb as the cocky but talented pilot Maverick, and Kelly McGillis sizzles as the civilian instructor who teaches him a few things you can't learn in a classroom. Featuring a sensational soundtrack featuring unforgettable songs including Berlin's Take My Breath Away and Kenny Loggins' Danger Zone. The film also stars Val Kilmer, Anthony Edwards, Meg Ryan, and Michael Ironside. Oh, what's that? Michael Ironside? That's right, the one and only Michael Ironside, who you may remember we have talked to on the show before. What's that? You say you're not quite sure you remember who he is? It's a little familiar. Who does he play? Is he that one guy? Well, yes. Yes, he is that one guy. As a matter of fact, here on the show, we have featured Mr. Michael Ironside, the established, esteemed actor, as one of our focuses on our That One Guy series. And instead of going into all the details of all the characters that he has played that you do remember, I guarantee you, why don't we take some time and flash back? Yeah, that's right. Let's all just brace ourselves for a repeat. I know, but still, this is Michael Ironside. And the reason we've got to do another encore presentation is because we're still hard at work in the studio with, believe it or not, a brand new, just recorded, fresh off the digital track, never before heard interview with Michael Ironside. Yes, that's right, a new one. Plus, we've got interviews with Sean Patrick Flannery. You remember him from Powder, Boondock Saints. He's also an accomplished author. We're going to talk about all of that. We've also got one with a new friend of the show, one of our Comic-Con buddies, Mr. Glenn McIntosh. Not quite sure where you know that name. Trust me, you know it. He has been working with Industrial Light and Magic. That's ILM. Who, well, let's say he was in charge of all the dinosaur effects in Jurassic World. So, kind of a big deal. And many more episodes all leading up to our Comic-Con coverage this summer. And, ooh, boy, are we busy. I promise you, we're not trying to blow you off. But as long as we're going to be going back over Michael Ironside soon, let's brush up. As a matter of fact, without any ado.
All right.
All right, you guys want to start the show?
Let's start the show.
In the Great Hall of the Justice League.
This is for you new people. I only have one rule.
You never leave your wingman.
Madre de Dios.
Not exactly. But if it makes you feel better to pray.
Please don't kill me.
If you don't do your job, I'll shoot you. You get me. I'm not a tuxedo kind of guy.
But you are some kind of spy.
Yeah, I'm the real kind. Not the tuxedo kind.
Everyone fights, no one quits.
I'm uploading the arming sequence codes for Grimm.
Welcome to the Roughnecks.
Ratcat, Roughneck!
See you at the party, Richter!
I know that voice. I know that,
that voice. That
voice,
yeah? Well, yeah, that last one was Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Well, I know, but I know that line.
That's right.
And I know who he's talking to.
That's right.
And he's that one guy.
That one guy. I'm glad you put it like that because, you know, who he was talking to was Richter, and who he is played by is Mr. Michael Ironside.
Fuck
and
yeah.
Yes, he Michael Ironside is awfully fitting.
Yeah,
I would say since I want to try something new this show, Mark. Uh-huh. I want to go with a theme, uh-huh, which is, and you said it right, that one guy.
That one guy.
That one guy. When I say that, I mean, you know, all the movies that we watched growing up, me, you, all the other serialites out there listening, who, you know, once we were just getting a little too old for cartoons, mm-hmm, still too young to get into rated R movies in the theater.
But we were anyway.
But we still got to see them on cable at our friend's, yeah, house or when our parents rented them and then they went to work.
Yeah.
We still got to see, you know, when we were growing up, all these movies with, you know, Tom Cruise, Arnold Schwarzenegger, all the big stars of the 80s.
Stallone.
But all of those movies had someone else starring in them as well, you know.
Yeah.
They always had, you know, that one guy.
That one guy.
That one guy.
That one guy.
That one guy from that movie, you remember?
And that one guy shows up in many awesome, amazing parts in these awesome, amazing,
yeah,
movies.
For yeah, all of those movies that you watched as a kid on HBO so that we can appreciate some of the background players, some,
right,
of the supporting actors who have been so important and such pivotal roles in some of these movies that helped raise us as kids, especially now that Arnold Schwarzenegger is kind of washed up, Tom Cruise is a crazy person. Val Kilmer's a big
bat.
Yeah, Macy's blimp at this point. There's a lot of appreciation, I think, to be had when we start to remember the guys who played right next to him.
It's the guys that were like, I saw him in this.
Yeah.
He was the guy in the.
Who was he? He wasn't the main bad guy in Die Hard, but he had a gun.
Yeah,
stuff like that. Who are those guys?
Exactly.
Well, here in Matty P's Presents Saturday Morning Serial, Marky and myself, Grim Shea, we're here on a mission to help remind you and to help celebrate them. And this week, we could think of no better person to bring it all out with but Michael Ironside.
Absolutely.
What a fucking awesome tough guy.
Yep.
But if you just walk up to some strangers on the street and say his name, they're more than likely not going to know who you're talking about. But give them a picture,
yep,
point out a scene, offer a line, not even one that they said, like how Schwarzenegger, everybody knows, see you at the party, Richter.
Yeah. And
so when I say to you, hey, buddy, you know who Michael Ironside is?
No.
You go, no. If I say, hey, I'll see you at the party, who's Richter? They're like,
that one guy.
That one guy. Yeah. So that's what I want to celebrate because these, they're so good quite often.
And let's hope that this is the first of many.
Oh.
I mean.
I would just like to just get through this one. But yeah.
Yeah, me too.
But me too.
Oh, this is this guy. This.
Yeah. That one guy. Remember that guy? Well, this week, this episode devoted entirely to basically a big love letter to the guy who got second billing in so many of those movies that helped raise us, Mr. Michael Ironside. You know, so
he's that one guy from V.
He's that one guy from Total Recall.
He's that one guy from Top Gun.
You know, that one guy from The Next Karate Kid.
He's that one guy from X-Men First Class.
He's That one guy who does the voice for Darkseid on Justice League.
He's the one guy from Smallville.
He's that one guy from Starship Troopers.
He's the one guy from Criminal Minds.
No, he's that one guy from Law and Order.
No, he's the one guy from Terminator Salvation.
Oh, he's okay. Okay, I think we get the idea, because you can play this game for days with Michael Ironside.
Exactly. This guy, it's fitting that we start with him because, I mean, just off the top of my head, I'm going to go backwards, just backwards. He was just in an episode of Community.
Mm-hmm.
I remember him from, that out of nowhere really cool movie we just saw, Extraterrestrial.
Extraterrestrial.
Right?
Yep. He was one of the scene stealer in that.
Absolutely. Off the top of my head, he was he played Lois Lane's father, General Lane, in Smallville in the series.
Oh,
he was like
in
three or four of those episodes.
And hell, that's Superman canon at
that point. That's Superman. He's Superman canon.
Oh, he does the voice of Darkseid.
Yeah, he played Darkseid, which mm-hmm. is, believe me, not only an iconic comic character, but you can hear Darkseid's voice when you're reading the comics. And it might as well sound like Michael Ironside.
Hell, his voice is in Splinter Cell.
Splinter Cell.
In fairness, that's probably the only time he's actually a leading man across several like blockbuster, top-selling, genre-defining video games, in which you hear a lot more of his dialogue than you hear of anybody in any movie, because it lasts hours and hours, and it's so repetitive, and he's still cool in that.
And it's, you know what, and it's, I have no idea off the top of my head, but maybe Splinter Cell has grossed more than any movie he's ever been in.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know.
It's pulled in probably a few billion dollars
over
the last decade or so.
Wasn't there like this, wasn't he like replaced, and there was like some like campaign to like bring him back or something?
No, there's always going to be a campaign, but he was replaced, but I think he was all right with it. We talked about it. I don't want to get into it right now, but trust me, working backwards.
Splinter Cell, right?
Splinter Cell back in the 2000s. If you remember those days.
Yeah.
Before that, he was in lots of TV and movies.
Starship
movies.
Troopers.
Starship Troopers. He was the kick-ass sergeant
with the metal hand.
With the metal arm.
Yeah.
Save their asses. He was things like Top Gun.
Little
movie.
Total Recall.
Total Recall. He's never been, aside from possibly, as I mentioned, Splinter Cell franchise, he's never been the leading man. But trust me, you know this guy. If you don't get it from us describing him already, Jester from Top Gun, Richter from Total Recall.
Leading into what memory was of him, and really one of my first memories of television and science fiction, he played... Tyler, I believe, was his name in the original miniseries, later series, V.
Oh, V.
The miniseries.
Like on TV.
Yes.
Early 80s.
Maybe 82, 83.
Yeah.
You know, this show was iconic. They tried to bring it back about 5 years ago, and as a deep, passionate fan of the original series, the new one was just complete garbage.
I tried to.
Marina Baccarin, who is from Firefly, is in it. Sarah Vanderroot, who played Supergirl in Smallville, is in it. And she's one of the most beautiful girls I've ever seen in my life. They are, both of these women are beautiful.
I try to give it as many chances as possible for many reasons.
Garbage.
The original was so good.
It was so good, but the reason why this new one sucks so bad is because they did not honor the original.
Mm-hmm.
There was not even a character that came anywhere close to the persona and the position of Michael Ironside in the original series.
Tyler, the scoundrel who ended up being the savior. I mean, still not even the leading man, fucking Mark Singer. Where's he?
The pretty
but
boy.
Michael Ironside is still doing movies.
He was the badass in that series. He was the guy, for all of you guys out there that are too young to remember V, for all of you out there that are too old to remember, I use that differently there. But if you guys don't know this. He played the part of the mercenary, arms dealer, scoundrel, criminal, part. But he's the guy that you want when it comes to any kind of apocalypse, be it nuclear, alien, zombie, whatever.
The ultimate friend in need
kind of scenario
where you want him in jail right up until
you want him on your side. Yeah. You know, this is the guy that when shit goes down,
you want him. And he was totally at home in that role and really owned it as a tough guy who seemed just trustworthy enough but never vulnerable. And this was something he carried over, I mean, when he did Top Gun, when he was Jester. You picture, when I say Jester in Top Gun, you know, I hope, you listening at home, that's what was written on the top of his flight helmet.
Yep, yep.
That was his flight name.
Yeah.
And he was the teacher. His call sign.
Yeah, yeah.
His nom de plume. Although, if he were here in the room and heard me say nom de plume, he'd probably punch me.
He would definitely punch you. But, you know, he played... If you look at the brevity of his role, in these different films that we all can kind of remember him in, he does tend to play the tough motherfucker.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but it's not always the same role in the context of the story that they're trying to promote. He's not always the tough motherfucker that's the bad guy.
Yeah.
Right. Sometimes
they never get him for the shallow tough guy roles. They get him for the deeper but underappreciated shadowed part.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. In V, he was the tough guy that you wanted on your side, right?
Yep.
In what was the next one that we saw him in?
Top Gun,
He was the tough guy who was the mentor, who was the herald. You know, he was the guy that was going to take the main character and move him along.
He's the one who, in War Games, killed Tom Cruise, but only so that he had the chance to tell him, with meaning, you never leave your wingman.
Oh, my God. That
and if that didn't help define your childhood, that line right there, you probably don't know why you're listening to this.
Every time that you hear that phrase in popular culture, which I probably heard it two or three times this year, you never, ever leave your wingman.
Yep.
You want to know who says that? Michael Ironside.
That's Michael fucking Ironside right there.
Ironside.
So you know what? You're listening to an IMDb deep cut right now, and you never leave your wingman.
Can we just play that again, or that little clip?
Play this?
That was some of the best flying I've seen yet. Right up to the part where you got killed. You never, never leave your wingman.
Yeah, that's right. Michael Ironside.
That thing is...
That's Jester.
Jester.
And you know what? That's like a sympathetic tough guy role, which is great because about a year later or so, if I remember my childhood right, Total Recall comes out.
There is
Richter.
Nothing good about this guy at all.
Mm-mm.
Richter is pure bad guy.
Not the flat... And I know a lot of you at home, and maybe one day we'll do a Kurtwood Smith...
I would love
cut,
that. Just
but a lot of people
lines.
Are going to, confuse him with, I think, almost that same year's similar antagonist role in RoboCop, played by Kurtwood Smith. But the guy was evil with still having a vulnerability, a breaking point.
Right.
Whereas your Ronnie Cox from RoboCop
that's more of like a bureaucratic, money-hungry kind of evil.
He's right. The last boss in the video game.
Exactly.
The one beforehand that you fight most of the movie, that's the Michael Ironside kind of... He kind of established that role, I think, in Total Recall. And you saw it used so many times in Die Hard. It was fucking Russian ballet dancer who
Hans,
wouldn't even...
No, not Hans.
Choked to death on
God,
the chain.
What's his name?
But there was just a common thread of that second-tier bad guy. And I think it was very well established by Michael Ironside in Total Recall with Richter.
Yeah, absolutely.
That was the second-tier bad guy. You fight the whole time. You get rid of him. Now you just got to shoot an old man.
Now, for anybody here that wants to point to the new Colin Farrell one, okay? I mean, that's a fine movie. It's good. Based on its own merits, it's a fine movie. I'm not going to say anything bad about it. But for those of you that don't remember, and if you can't bear it nowadays, it's a little aged.
It is.
Okay.
If you didn't watch it as a kid,
right.
If you're a kid right now, don't watch it.
But anybody right now that can hear my voice, right, when the words, "See you at the party, Richter," come, when you hear that and Arnold throws a pair of severed arms over the ledge.
Yeah. Down the empty elevator shaft.
Right.
Towards the poor man's
when
falling
he says,
body.
"See you at the party, Richter." Richter is
Michael Ironside.
Michael Ironside. That is the role and the position that is the role and the position that this man fills in our minds. Those of us that grew up,
and I think that was
with Saturday morning cartoons, right? We are the last generation.
Our generation. As soon as we were just a little too old to watch the cartoons, and we're just a little too young to get away. Technically, with watching rated R movies, but they came in VHS form, rented by our parents. That was it.
That was it.
And in my opinion, it was either Michael Ironside right then who invented the second tier bad guy, or it was, like I mentioned, Kurtwood Smith and RoboCop.
Yeah.
We might even have to look it up to see which movie came out first.
I think you might even be confused because Brian Cox is the main guy in both those movies. He's the guy in RoboCop.
Ronnie Cox.
I'm sorry, Brian. Yeah. Ronnie Cox.
And
right.
I'm not even sure if it was Ronnie, but it was the exact the same hair,
the same
makeup,
guy.
And role.
Yeah.
But yeah, who had a second tier identical bad guy right below him? And we might have to look up who. And it's probably Shakespeare who first invented that with Iago or whatever. But in my mind, the '80s action movies, you had the main good guy and the main bad guy up until Total Recall, when you had Michael Ironside as the enforcer.
The enforcer. That's the position right there. He, you know, which in Star Wars terms, that's the Darth Vader. You know, like he's the guy that you have to get through to get to the main guy. And he's really your final test. Like, are you ready to face the bad guy? Are you ready to get there? Well, you have to beat this one first. Like, this is your final step, your final test. If you can get past this guy, then you can take the big guy on.
Yep, and
he plays that role.
That's the role that he was relegated to, and it turns out he's been able to work a lot longer than some of the leading men from the '80s.
I haven't seen Mark Singer. I think he spells it incorrectly with a C, but anyway, other than that, he seems like a pretty nice guy. You know,
How about Val Kilmer?
You can
kind of see him from here.
Yeah, he's just a big fat guy now.
No, I'm kidding. No, I love Val Kilmer,
I love him too.
But I understand he's nuts and fat.
I think so, yeah. Who else? Tom Cruise is crazy now.
Tom Cruise is crazy. He's still getting a lot of money. But,
but he's the guy that has survived.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, from what I recently heard, wink, wink, he's Canadian too. I had no idea. Yeah.
He is not just Canadian. He's Canuck.
He's very Canuck, eh?
And I didn't notice till not to spoil anything for a few minutes from now, but I did talk to him.
I know that.
I had a chance to speak with him. And since I did, and he was just using his normal speaking voice, which, don't get me wrong, is still pretty tough.
Yeah.
But now it's kind of like toof. You know? He's a tough guy.
But ever since
that interview, now I've gone back and I've watched him in a few of these roles just in the course of a couple of weeks. And his Canadian accent comes out more than you realize.
Well,
he's just too strong to let it on usually. But let me tell you about it.
Yeah, well, you know, in my recent research with him as well, I was kind of hearing that now. In my mind's eye, that's not what comes out. You know, there's nothing but just iconic images of this man, and how completely and totally jealous I am that you got to talk to him and not me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I am broken inside. And, you know, I feel also very grateful because there are few people in this world that I would be speechless with, you know. When I met Mark Hamill, I was very speechless, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But right with them, you know, would be Michael Ironside. What do I say? You know, like, I don't know what to tell you. I don't know how to begin to explain just my
deep-rooted, utter appreciation and love for this man's career and the position that he fills in my mind.
And yet it would be kind of weird to express that to other people without first explaining who he is. Because, you know, you name a couple of roles he's played, people are going to be, I remember him
from that one.
But sometimes, if you're not talking to the right person, they're like, why do you like him so much? He was just a bad guy in a bunch of movies or something like that. And they don't really get how important he is, how present he was in the whole tapestry of entertainment of us growing up that we kind of clung to.
I don't know if there will ever be anyone that's like has such visual facial recognition, right? Like you could ask anyone on the streets, do you know who Michael Ironside is? And they're gonna go, I don't know. You know, you show them a picture, they're gonna go, oh yeah, that's the guy from.
Mm-hmm.
The guy from. So, you know, that's the position that he plays. But all of us, especially in, you know, what ends up being now the Saturday morning serial culture, you know, mm-hmm. the pop culture of today, we all kind of grew up in the era where Michael Ironside was an integral part of these iconic imagery, of these iconic films, and he's still with us now.
Yeah.
You know, like
he was present in the background in so many of what I guess I would call my babysitting sessions growing up.
Yeah, maybe
that
so.
He kind of deserves a little credit for helping raise me.
Yeah.
Even if it was just the tough guy in the corner I was scared to death of.
He was also, let's not discredit the power of the technology of the time as well.
Mm-hmm.
Chances are Michael Ironside is on an old VHS recordable cassette that might be in your mom's attic right now.
You live in a part of the country that has an attic?
Yeah.
Go up there.
Is this
you
up
live
there?
In a part that has a basement? Go down,
go down there.
I bet you'll find
a tape.
Him on one of those VHS tapes that your parents bought at some point.
Or that we recorded off a cable or whatever. But the point is we watched him I've seen Total Recall probably 50 times.
Yep.
You know? I saw Top Gun just as many times. So he's a part of he is a part of that culture on its own, but he's also a product of the times where he's in a median that we had to consume over and over and over again. We could not turn on the internet and get something new. We had to go in our own library and pull out that VHS that we had of Top Gun and watch it over.
And he would have been in a lot of those.
Yeah, a lot of them. Yeah, I mean, he's just so important to that.
And he's still working today, so hats off to him. There are some of those from the old days who aren't so much employed anymore, even if they're still around and kicking. But Michael Ironside, when I got to talk to him, I was just impressed at what a professional, like, actor he was. And I got to be honest with you here, and I'm not trying to blow smoke up the guy's ass or anything, but he was an awesome interview because I just happened to mention that I remembered him as being the voice of Sam Fisher
in Splinter Cell.
And immediately before he even, like, we must have gotten a few minutes in before he was like, oh, wait, are we recording this? Is the interview going?
Really?
Before he even got there, he was just like, oh, let me tell you about that. That was a great, and he talked about it completely as someone who knows nothing about playing video games but knows everything about being an actor and how he basically helped rewrite the script and establish this character.
Yeah.
But anyway, I feel like I've made us all wait long enough. Do you want to hear me talk to my man, my main man, Michael Ironside? Are you ready, Marquis?
We might as well just get this done.
That's probably exactly what he said before he answered the phone. All right, take us away, Magic Interview Machine, and give me a little bit of Michael Ironside.
Meanwhile,
is this a little better?
Yeah, you're just dropping out just a little bit, but that's okay.
All right. Well, it's been a lifelong pattern of mine, actually.
And what's your name again?
All right. Grim Shea. It's
Grim Shea. My God, that's a handle to live up to.
It is. It is. I fail all the time at it. I want to thank you for talking with us today. I am a huge fan, and I think I speak for a lot of our listeners when I say that a lot of the roles that you've played you were in almost all the movies that I taped on VHS growing up and watched until the tape just completely broke.
So you're what, 48, 50?
not quite. Don't give yourself that many years.
No, this how old are you?
37, actually. 37.
Really? I taping at an early age.
Well, you were Jester in Top Gun and Richter in Total Recall, and you've definitely been a big part of the entertainment tapestry that I grew up in front of, and I thank you for that.
Oh, you're welcome.
And even beyond that, when you were Sam Fisher in the Splinter Cell games, I think you were the first foray into getting like a high-powered quality star to play a serialized character in a video game, and I loved it. I had all of them.
Yeah. Also, I think it was the first time we ever really fleshed out a character in a story. Do you want to start the interview now or?
Oh yeah. This is all taped, so say whatever you like. I'll try not to keep you too long. We'll get to everything we need to, but yeah, I'd love to hear your take on that.
When that was sent to me, I'm not a gamer. I wasn't then. I'm not now. When it was first sent to me quite a few years ago, I had no idea. I thought it was like Pong or something that they wanted me to narrate, and they sent a fairly substantial check, and I said absolutely. My wife went out and bought an SUV, and then they sent me the script over, and it was this very shallow two-dimensional script and character who was going around slaughtering people and saying guttural things about them, and I said, no, I'm not going to do this. And they said, what do you mean? And I said, well, it's not based on any kind of reality. The character is very shallow. It's not humanistic. It's written to accommodate your technology, the technology really should accommodate the character to some extent. So they said, well, would you rethink it and sit down? So I sat down and helped them restructure some of the development of the character. And look, I'm well aware that it was a video game and stuff, and that the parameters they were giving for the character were not a great deal of their concern. But without that, I don't think the game could be a success, I said. So I guess I ended up with about 20-25% of the input into the actual structure of the game to create a person who has some kind of an emotional history and some kind of a storyline and humanity or absence of humanity in places that makes him identifiable to people. And it seemed to work because it was the first game that I think had done that or even, and I got to give kudos and hats off to the five guys that owned Ubisoft, that was a big risk of theirs. They had a way of doing things that was pretty well proven to work for them within a limited scale of success and stuff. And to step out on a limb and create this kind of dramatic kind of situation and a game with it involved was a risk, not only financial, but a brand risk for them. And thank God it paid off.
It really paid off.
Really did. It was quite wonderful to watch that. Voice actors had been used to stepping into booths, I think, and doing these kind of jobs by themselves. And on the first two, I had them bring in an acting director kind of coach, this fellow named Sean. I don't want to embarrass him with his last name, but he came in and Sean Stanek came in and he oversaw the first two couple of games. And he was very deft at storytelling. And I also had them bring in the actors so that we could interact with each other. So we're not just working in a kind of a vacuum until we got our characters established over those first two games, because they were split up, I think, by about 3 years. And that seemed to work. That way of working seemed to work. It made it more organic and more successful.
That really comes through, too.
I told them, I said, if you're going to get into the arts and you're going to get into the creation of humanity and try and involve some kind of humanity in this electronic kind of
exercise that you have here, you better get some people who are good at it. And, you know, and they listened to their credit, you know. And that's, and I really mean that. I'm not trying to kiss their ass or anything like that. It really means something that, you know, when you've got a way of doing things that's safe and it's predictable and somebody comes in with an idea that, you know, that makes sense, but it's frightening, and they were willing to take that risk, you know.
I had no idea that so much of that credit should go to you. But now that you explain it, makes perfect sense. I mean, you weren't dealing with actual casting directors and people who've been in theater or anything. These are video game guys.
These are mostly people who are, there's a certain antisocial element to, I think, gamers and gaming, and at that time, to the kind of personality who was not your rah-rah system Bob crowd-pleasing guy. It was usually somebody who was almost masturbatory, if there is such a word. And now it isn't. Now, I remember when the first game came out, I was on a Swiss Air to, I think I was going to Paris or someplace, and I ordered a cup of tea. And I said, can I get a cup of tea? And then all of a sudden I looked up and there was this guy standing in a kind of like a vest and an open shirt with his tie undone and said, Sam Fisher. And I said, no, I'm Michael. And I went, oh, wait a second. Yeah, I guess I am Sam Fisher. And he was not your stereotypical gamer. He was a man flying first class to Paris and was an executive and used the game as a bridge between him and his son. And when the game came, the second games come out, and the third games where they were, then they started being interactive with other people, more than one player, and they had your chat boxes on the side. They became kind of a global phenomenon for people to actually communicate while they're playing. So I remember I was talking. I was in Johannesburg working on a film, and a guy came up and said, "Yeah, I was playing your game and talking to somebody over in Vancouver, and another guy was in Melbourne. We were all playing, and he tasked us about the food riots in Johannesburg that he'd had on the news. And I told him it's bullshit. There was only six people that entered the food stamps, and they bussed them to another place. So these guys were actually using it to circumvent kind of the controlling of news media and stuff. Uh-huh. There's a whole, you know what I mean? It became there's a community around gaming that they basically tell each other the truth, and you can, if you hear a story, you can call some of your gaming friends up pull them up on the chat box and say, what's going on in Beijing? What's going on in Melbourne? Is this true?
Thanks to the technology that finally came along, there was that antisocial edge to gaming when you would just sit alone in your house and game, and then it turned into like an alternative kind of sociality.
It's gone from being antisocial on a physical level of not being able to find your ilk with a crowd to being quite a community now, which is I like that. You know what I mean? I think life's too short to not be plugged in somewhere and in communication with somebody or on some level of society where you can take your problems or ask for information. If we don't have that, we end up sort of like packing on ammunition and walking onto, mall places,
Yeah. Well, I think the Splinter Cell games deserve a lot of credit for that because they
were the first of their kind.
They came out during a time when a lot of games, no matter how good they were, either they got lucky and succeeded and got a sequel, or they were forgotten about in a few weeks. And I think your actual character help keep that franchise going until we have what we have today.
Well, I know that Ubisoft's stock went from 335 to, I think, 1750 in like 18 months and then split twice since then. So,
You deserve more than just one SUV for the wife for that.
Well, thank you. No, I'm just grateful to be working. I really am.
Oh,
what else you want?
Yeah, well, I guess we should probably talk about Extraterrestrial while I got you on the line. I just saw a screener last night. I know you're out in New York getting ready to do another screening for the Comic-Con.
Yeah, we're doing a Comic-Con screening tonight, yeah. Then we'll do a chat question afterwards.
Well, I expect you are going to get a lot of appreciation at that because it's more than a cameo, but you're not one of the lead characters, but my God, by the end of it, I really wish you had been in it more. You were amazing, and I loved what you did with what otherwise is a pretty flat kind of character trope.
Well, Travis, the character is kind of interesting. He's got to be representative of all that generation before them, because it's a bunch of young people out in the woods, kind of sci-fi slasher, murder mystery, all in the same, rolled into one. And he has to represent that whole generation that's in ahead of these kids. So he's, you know, and he's a Vietnam vet and all these other things, but he has to, you know, he basically, and then you got law enforcement being, you know, represented, you know, by Gil Bellows like that and Sean Rogerson. And so there's it's kind of a multifaceted obligation and job in playing that character. I remember when I read the script and I read through it twice because I didn't believe it was good as it was the first time. And I liked it. And then I met the boys. I met Colin and Stuart, the Vicious Brothers, and asked them some questions, and they weren't in any kind of competition with each other. They sort of talked openly in front of me about something. They said, "Yeah, well, that," and they answered my questions. And it was interesting to watch two people that were in that much simpatico with each other, that were in basically a position. It's usually a mono position, you know, the tribal leader. And so I sort of said, "Yeah, let's try this." You know, the character's concise. The writing's good. The storytelling element that's in the hands of the directors seemed to be in deft hands, and it turned out to be a wonderful. I don't usually do these sort of things, but I like the outcome of this film. I saw a fine cut without most of the special effects on it about 4 or 5 months ago, and I was very pleasantly pleased. And I got to tell you, without, I don't kiss too many people's asses or anything like that, but Brittany Allen, I think, is wonderful. From the moment I met her and started working with her, she's one of those actresses that is available. It's almost like, you know, it's like playing, I used to use an analogy of playing tennis. You know, you hit the ball and you got to go get it and hit it back to yourself. And some people lob, you know, you hit the ball to them and they lob it right back into the, you know, the netting. And with Brittany, she had all her tools. Her tool set is wonderful. The way she works is wonderful. She's there 100%. You know, she's a professional, and she's an absolute delight to work with. You know, it was just a wonderful, wonderful experience working with her.
Yeah, and that's a good thing, because I was just talking to her and the Vicious Brothers, and I think she is in just about every frame of that movie. Oh. I mean, she had a lot on her shoulders there.
Oh, she had a huge workload on her shoulders, and it's not easy in playing a lead. A lot of times you're kind of like the wall on the handball court. You know, the character actors come in and bounce the balls off you, and you probably get 2 or 3 moments. You got to be very careful that you don't sort of blow your load in every scene, because that can become monotonous. You know, and she kept, from what I saw, that fine cut I saw, that she kept this wonderful innocence and honesty and emotional kind of credibility through the whole project. It's such a difficult role. And I came away an absolute fan. I just saw her. I hadn't seen her in about 6 months. I just saw her coming up in the elevator for these interviews. And I lit up like a Christmas tree. It's so great to be around. You know, I really see great things in the future for her. She's such a good actress.
Well, she's already got an Emmy under her belt at a young age, which is certainly not a bad start. And the work that, she got a daytime Emmy, but still, to get an Emmy is not an easy feat. And then to carry a movie like this, she's amazing. I am going to keep my eye on her for sure.
Did you like what you saw in the film?
Oh, I did, very much. And what impressed me so much was that, and I asked them exactly what the budget was, and when they said $3 million, I was floored. I mean, I was not aware of 30, $50 million up on that screen.
You know, they put a lot, well, they worked very well. A lot of us knew that there was not a lot of money up front. Most of it was going to go into special effects and stuff like that. But it starts with the story. It all starts with the story, and then it goes to the storyteller. The story was good, you know, and I thought they're at least competent, so that, you know, because I knew it was like their first or second time out. And they turned out to be more than competent. They enjoyed things. They knew when to let go and say, "Could you try something?" And then go, "Wow, that works." And or they'd say, "No, we need it over here. We need to pull it in here." And it was, you know, and I felt very safe with their direction. I didn't feel like I was being misled. Which
their skill is, it's difficult to explain. I was thinking about it ever since I finished the movie last night, but it's almost like they came up with just some very stereotypical, flat, kind of characters and ideas, but then they built straight up from there so that when you see the movie, it's an actual story and the characters seem like actual people. They're not just throwaways.
Yeah, there,
everybody,
there, it,
everybody behaves so well.
Yeah, they took a formulaic way of doing things and upgraded it. You know, they bought a Chevy Malibu and turned it into a Cadillac. And
exactly, well put.
And it really is. I was more than pleasantly surprised. I knew the very first day on set and stuff like that. When I looked at the camera and positions and how they were giving everything a certain amount of conscious detail and weren't allowing themselves to be rushed over something. And I thought making the right choices and coverage that I'd seen before. Probably within 2 hours of being on set, I totally relaxed and was completely putty in their hands, you know?
Well, if you've got people who are talented like that and can work with what they're given and turn it into something so much more than the sum of its parts,
yeah,
that's great. And they work with so many genres, and they manage to pull them all off, including very good in the sci-fi, which I'm a fan of, which really does sell. And then you add that great horror element, kind of the slasher film, just in time for Halloween too. They're no fools, but
I think they're excellent storytellers. It's all, you know, the old idea is that sci-fi is just westerns in a different setup, you know, and it's so true. You know, it's they're good storytellers. They're really good storytellers.
Well, I it got me thinking, especially when I realized I was going to get to talk to you. It reminded me of, like, you'll probably remember this, and I know anyone who thinks like I do will remember this, but that old show V from the 80s.
Yeah, that was 80s.
Where they had to do it very rushed with a very limited budget, but they had this epic grand scale, you know, alien invasion idea. And the older I get, the more I look back and
really
appreciate the actual story.
Yeah, but that was Dan Blatt and Bob Singer, the producers on that. They had a very specific way of producing that show, and they knew that if they compromised the scope of that story, it would kill it. Do you know the V was originally structured to be a miniseries, as if what happened if the United States had not gotten into the Second World War and the Nazis had won in Europe and took over Europe? And the networks evidently looked at it and said, we can't do this, because it was that whole idea of North America being isolated by the water and Europe and Eurasia being taken over by a super right wing. So he went back and he sort of said, well, what can I do? And he turned the Nazis into aliens, and he turned, you know what I mean, and found a way of segmenting the world and dealt with that kind of political element of the story, which I thought was wonderful.
Yeah, so, and that's something that when I was a kid watching with my mom, I didn't pick up on. But now, and I've gone back and I've watched it a couple of times, at least most of the series, and just the parallels are right there. I mean, even like with the third column and stuff. Like,
absolutely,
they weren't trying to hide it. They were just presenting it so well.
And he went, and of course he took the ball. And once they said yes, he just took the ball and ran with it. And, I was aware of it right from the beginning that it was a political, you know, and I went, wait a second, these uniforms and the attitude and the idea of aliens and internment camps and, you know, the intellectuals and science and stuff. So I was very aware of it having a political kind of scope to it, and was, you know, and it was way before its time. It got crushed after it, I think it was its 12th or 13th show. The head of the studio at the time, nor the head of the network at the time, was having a problem with Dan Blatt and Bob, and I think they pulled the plug on the show when they thought they had enough to get it into syndication if they chopped up the miniseries. Evidently, they came up a couple hours short, and so there was a personality clash between the head of the network at that time and the producers. But I'm glad it got made. You know, it was... It seemed to open a door for a lot of other things to take risks.
Yeah, and just the way that it had that scope, and I don't think in TV people were doing things with that kind of vision, you know, or at least I don't look back and remember anything like that I loved so much as a kid, and I didn't know 2/3 of what was going on the screen. And I can go back and watch it again, and it doesn't have to be a blockbuster. I don't have to be watching Jurassic Park or something.
You know, it's also interesting. I was just thinking that my wife and I just celebrated 28 years of marriage and 30 years together.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. And a lot of it goes to her, too. We're very much a team. But my very first day on V, I was from Canada, and I was down here doing this show for the first time. I had done an A-Team episode and something else in Till Street Blues. And then this thing, Dan Black called the agency, said, we have been trying to get a hold of Ironside for like 8 months now. Where is he? You know, because I was in Canada, based out of Canada. They sent me over, and the very first day at work, I met my partner, which was Chris Farber in the show, was played by Mickey Jones, and he became my lifelong best friend, one of my best friends. He was best man at my wedding a year later, and I just saw him last week, actually. He's in the hospital. He's about to get a kidney transplant, if they can find a right kidney match for him. So, but there was a lot of good things happened on that show, a lot of good.
See, the more I hear about it, did you just offhand? Did you see the new one, the remake?
Somebody called and wanted to know if I wouldn't want to do an episode of that, and I said really not. I don't want to go back and re-enter reestablish that character on for a moment. Ham Tato is a very specific character. He originally was supposed to be in a wheelchair when they sent it over to me. The writer had also written a film called Visiting Hours. And when he was the one that got kind of approached me with the project and said, will you take a look at this V thing, the miniseries? And so we went off, and I said, well, I can't do it. My name's Ironside. The last thing I'm going to sit in is a wheelchair. And they said, well, could you think of restructuring it in some way? So we went off to Palm Springs for 3 or 4 days and came up with that kind of a character that can't give affection or accept affection because of his loss of his family and stuff, and restructured the Ham Tyler. And we came back, and Dan Blatt and Bob Singer took one evening of reading, and they called us up and said, yeah, we'll go for it. It's cool. Come on aboard, you know. And so I have a lot of fond memories about that because it was my first real introduction to American television and filmmaking, and it was a fairly smooth ride, you know. A few personalities on the show that were difficult to deal with, but it was a good introduction because I was used to working on very independent, very small budget films in Canada where everyone's essential, and on any given day the craft service guy might be more important than the director. You know. And so to walk, to be around any kind of eccentric or self-centered ego would have been difficult. So, and that show was a great introduction to American television for me.
Oh, good. Because I think it was a great introduction for America to you, too. I know you had been doing
I never saw the reissue of it. I heard that it got a little too much into the art and the concept, and not enough into the story. Somebody told
me. Yeah. I think they had the exact opposite vision of what they were able to do in the original series V. And
They
tried to front load it with a lot of visuals that they obviously couldn't afford, and then all the characters and situations just ended up coming out flat.
I did give it a chance.
I was a big V fan. I tried as hard as I could for that show, but in the end, I just had to walk away.
You got to treat an audience with respect. You really do. An audience has to be treated with respect and be taught as a sensitive, intelligent entity. And tell them, if you're going to tell them a bedtime story, you better have your crap together, because you just can't flash, you know, teddy bears and unicorns at them and expect them to be satisfied. And I've watched that through. I mean, the most low budget English productions and stuff that are strong in story and strong in character do well. And you watch Americans throw more money into it and some of that, and try and reissue it or remake it or revisual. And if they don't pay respects to story and character, it falls flat.
Yep, and I think that is the V remake is the best example you could give of that as well. So thank you first for being in the original, and thank you for saying no to helping with the remake.
Well, you're welcome. You were welcome. I was glad to have another job to go to. It was easy to say no, but I am very fortunate. I get offered a lot of things.
Hey, Mark, it's Stephanie. So sorry to interrupt, but we have to wrap.
Oh, okay. That's all right. That's all right. Well, thank you so much, Mr. Ironside. I really appreciate talking to you again. Huge fan.
I hope you got enough to work with there. I apologize. I seem to just go off in tangents, but
no, you cannot imagine how much I like that as an interviewer. Thank you for shouldering the burden and being interesting.
Yeah, I don't want to blow too much smoke up anyone's ass, but I really do like this film. I don't come out and push and support things very often. But I think these guys are storytellers, and what they've done with the limited budget and limited story and resources and stuff have done a phenomenal job. It's not making excuses for the story. The story really works.
They work every angle right with it. I can't wait to see when they actually get $50 million. I will be the first one in line for that movie.
Well, we'll see. You take care.
All right. Thank you very much. Hope to talk to you again, and good luck at the screening. All right. That was Michael Ironside.
He said a lot there.
He did. I told you, man. That was like the dream interview.
It must be, because he just the guy you just – he's like a pond. You just drop the pebble, and then the ripples, you know, just –
That's true. That's a beautiful metaphor. But that's
really?
Actually, as an interviewer, I have to say, Marky, you kind of nailed it. Because all I did, I just mentioned Sam Fisher and how much I like that. And we had, like, the stuff he had to say just about working on a video game in the infancy of video games. I had no idea I was about to stumble across a little treasure like that.
Yeah, well, and you know, I wrote a couple of just like one word notes. One of them says professional. You know, like when I heard that interview, this is a guy that you hand him a script, and it sounds like he probably gets scripts of, you know, designers, writers, whatever, and these are guys that are thinking, in my wildest dreams, I wrote this part for a guy that's like Michael Ironside. Or I want him to sound like a Michael Ironside. And then all of a sudden,
at this point,
Michael
in the
Ironside,
cultural landscape,
right.
Michael Ironside is himself.
And he's available. And so these guys go and they approach him and they give him this. And this guy's like, oh, I know it's a video game, but we're trying to take it seriously. And here you go. And Michael Ironside looks at it and he goes, he can somehow smell the potential here and yet have the balls to tell this guy, I need a story here.
Let's redo this.
Yeah,
let's
why don't we redo this? I'll do it, but this is come on, guy.
I mean, he's a smart guy, and God, honestly, that I'm a video game player. Gamers,
right. I'm a gamer.
Call
I'm a gamer.
I'm not a gamer.
You're a
but
console
I'm a gamer.
Gamer.
I'm a console gamer.
So am I, though.
But I played the shit out of a bunch of Splinter Cell games like years ago.
Yeah.
And I heard him, you know, whisper those things in the dark.
Did you
sneak
know,
up behind a guy and break his neck? And
did you know it was him
Michael
before
Ironside?
You like,
yes,
looked
I,
it up?
I
yeah,
knew
you,
that
you,
was.
Obviously.
You know his voice.
Yeah,
and they brought it. And that video game franchise honestly did start a kind of thing where you could have mature games that featured the same character that wasn't Mario or Sonic.
Where he wasn't like a Mamma Mia.
When they started...
He actually
you know,
has
having
something
the
to
ability
say.
To put decent cutscenes and actual characters into mature games like Metal Gear Solid.
You're right, right.
And the main competitor in that field was Splinter Cell. You had Snake or you had Sam Fisher. And God damn it, Michael Ironside, Sam Fisher, and I thought that was a big deal. And apparently, as soon as I mentioned it, so did he.
I know. And
that was awesome.
Just going back to your, like, memory of this whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
When you popped in the game, did you know that you were in for a Michael Ironside experience?
Knowing it and being ready for it are such two different things.
Was there ever a point where you were like playing this game or you're buying this game or in the process of selecting this game where you went, Michael Ironside's in this? Like, when did that moment hit you?
That, I think, was... That actually isn't a small part of it.
Like, what do you mean? Like, this was big
news?
I
mean, because, no, it's like, okay, it's like, you have to understand, this was 10, 12 years ago when these games started coming out. So when you would go out to pick out a game, it was a lot like going to Blockbuster. to pick out a movie. So you honestly did have a lot of weight on, hey, is this a big name star in this?
Oh, really?
Is this so when you get to games, look, the very first Grand Theft Auto 3 or whatever, when they
had Michael Madsen,
finally had voices.
Or,
Ray
Liotta.
Not even that. It was, what was it, Richie from The Sopranos, Michael Rapaport, and a couple, I don't know.
Joe Pantoliano,
Joey Pants, whatever the hell his name is. Yes, he was one of the voice actors when that was a big deal. Actual celebrity, like actual actors, play video game characters was a very groundbreaking thing in the early 2000s. And no franchise did it better than Sam Fisher and Splinter Cell. This was one of the top-selling games. This was blockbuster. This was the Avengers in video games in 2003. And 4 and 5.
And whatever.
Forever, as far as I'm concerned. Sam Fisher, never die.
Well, I was just trying to just pipe into that moment when you're like, oh, my God, this is Michael Ironside in this. You know, I like playing that game where you're watching something or you're hearing something. It could be a Acura commercial, and you hear the voice, and you're like, who the hell is that? Who is that? I know that voice. I know that. It's just kind of deeply rooted into your heart, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, bam, you figure it out, and I was just kind of looking for that moment. You're like, oh, that's Michael fucking Ironside right there.
Oh, yeah, no, yeah. I knew it ahead of time. Sorry.
Good for you.
Oh, yeah.
That's good. That's good.
Because it mattered. Then.
It's recognition of a good man. And a body of work that is well represented. The next thing that I remember that I wrote down here was respect. Let's get into V a little bit.
Go for it.
I know you don't. Look, in my wildest dreams, our next show covers V in its entirety, the whole thing.
I'm
a huge, passionate fan of V, the series, the final battle.
Mm-hmm.
And just because it exists, even that hunk of crap that was the remake recently.
Mm-hmm.
I watched every episode because I felt like I had to. Okay. This show really changed everything. And maybe it was just because I was at an age where anything I would have seen would have changed everything. Because TV was 4 channels back then.
Yeah.
You had to make up your mind.
That's true.
Yeah.
It wasn't Wheel of Fortune. It wasn't local news. So probably that was the best thing on TV.
Well, it was like that or like Falcon Crest that, you know, that night, you know. You have very little option, but still, you know, Star Wars culture, you know, like in that era, sci-fi and all that.
And to make it to prime time in network with a special sci-fi event, it was a big deal.
Right. And this man's in it. And according to this interview, they even brought it up. You should be in the next one. And he's very well aware of his position in it and in its position in our culture now.
Yeah.
So he's very well aware of the stakes. And he just goes, nah, it's all right.
Nah, take a pass on it.
Yeah, pass on it.
I know you said, you know, it's a good thing.
And I know why.
Working. Yeah.
Respect. Because the guys that made this last one, this remake, didn't respect the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And that I think that's exactly what he says.
They didn't respect
us. And when I'm watching this remake, there were no tips of the hat, no Easter eggs, as I like to call them, to those of us that recognize the source material and that would remember, you know, like drop a name, you know, have like give us little kernels of inside jokes, baseball.
I watched a whole lot of it at the beginning, too, like the whole first season or something. And I don't quite remember any tips of the hat, like you said.
There's none.
But I still feel like there must have been one or two, and maybe I just didn't pick up on them, and I wasn't a good viewer. But nonetheless,
the only one,
it did not work the way the other one did.
The
original was good.
The only Easter egg they give you
is, well, no, let me just change that. There's two. Mm-hmm. One is the obvious where they pull their skin off and they're lizards.
Oh,
okay.
That's a simple one. Yeah.
But they also do the eating of the canary, eating of the bird.
Oh.
Okay. Subtle, but that's what we need. We need more of that, you know, and I wanted more of that. Like, there wasn't even, you know, a Michael Ironside character as realized by Michael Ironside.
Mm.
They didn't even do that, you know, and I know that they tried to bring him on or they attempted this, but that role needed to be filled, and they just didn't even, it just seemed like they didn't even attempt it. They completely got it wrong.
Yeah. I listen, hey, you got to believe me when I say I am completely on board with bashing the new V because it was horrible.
And it didn't last anyway, so who gives a shit?
Yeah. I mean, kind of thank God for that.
Yeah.
But, it smelled from far out, and I kept giving it chances.
Well, and in the,
I do kind of still
in the interview, though, what you nailed was why this show is on TV with blatantly obvious computer animated backgrounds. I mean, it was phenomenal in how bad it was.
Yeah.
Like, why is this on TV?
They were kind of daring us not to watch. I don't know what happened. There must have been some politics behind the scenes there. But he was part of the good V.
I know. And he was good enough to turn that down. Look, mm-hmm. We could all use a couple of bucks.
Yes.
If they
called me
bucks.
Today and said,
hey
Grimshay, do you want to be in the V that we made 7 years ago? We'll give you $400. I'd say, yep.
Bye.
Put my name all over it. Whatever. I'll show up.
When you're like, I don't know. I got to talk to the guy about some white walls.
Yeah. No, but that's because I really don't, I can't afford to have integrity. Yeah. Whereas Michael Ironside obviously does. He has incredible gravitas.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you sit back and you say, the poor guy is just typecast as a tough guy, and he'll never get away from that. Oh. That has given him like well over 200 some credits on IMDb. So, you know, don't cry for him, Argentina.
He's been in Hill Street Blues, A-Team, Law and Orders. What else? Off the top of your head.
Off the top of my head? No, I won't do that. That's like saying, geez, what's the color of the sky without saying blue? Quick.
I don't know.
The guy just did a star turn in Community.
Which
I am a huge fan of. And if I had had another 20 minutes with him in that interview, I would have asked him about it.
Absolutely.
Because I'd love to talk to him about that kind of thing. But, he's everywhere. He's still working. I don't know if he has perhaps a gambling addiction that he needs to feed, and that's why he won't retire. But he's clearly well within his rights to keep working. He's got skill, he's got talent, and he's happy that he's recognized but not a leading man. And that, once again, was the whole point. That's what we want to celebrate. We want to remind you who these guys are.
Absolutely.
Take you on our little tour of what we remember them, and we'll all remember their name. And in this case, we're talking about Richter. Right, Marky? Richter.
We're talking about Jester.
We're talking about Jester, remember?
Yeah.
We're talking about Ham Tyler.
Ham Tyler from V.
That's right.
Greatest.
We're talking about old...
Fuck you, True Detective.
Sergeant Ledoux or whatever from Starship Troopers with the fake arm.
Who was the guy with the pretty awesome. The mechanical arm.
Yep, exactly. Yep. Came, saved the day. The hard knocks teacher or the second-tier bad guy, depending on which movie you get into. Sometimes a little bit of both, sometimes a little bit of neither.
Mm-hmm.
The point being that Michael Ironside really inhabits and as well as kind of creates these that one guy roles. And all the stories through history, you know, all the archetypes and the Greek tragedies and comedies and Shakespearean plays have all been stocked with that one guy roles. I mean, like, there's, for every Hamlet, there's a Rosencrantz, and for every knight, there's a squire, and for every Jesus Christ, there's a Pontius Pilate. But we as a generation have had the chance to see all of these roles, all of our archetypes and oral traditions and fables and legends form right before us and shared in the exact same presentation with the exact same actors. So, because for every time Robert De Niro beats a guy to death on a movie, there's that one guy who played Billy Batts, Frank Vincent. And every time Jack Nicholson plays the Joker, there's that one guy who plays his lieutenant, Tracy Walter. You know who General Moff is, but who's the guy who played him? Take it away, Star Wars nerds. And so on and so forth. But I think you get what I'm saying here, which is that they deserve a certain amount of respect. They really do, because they are they prop up everything that you can recall right off the top of your head from all of your favorite movies. And Michael Ironside, well, there you go. That's our love letter to you.
So thank you, Michael Ironside. That was a lot of fun.
That's right. And if you don't think it was, come and fucking find us, Richter. Wait, let's call him out. What do you say?
Yeah, let's do that. I'll see you at the party, Richter.
Okay, you know it had to end with that line, don't you?
Now we know.
And knowing is half the battle.
Oh, this is enough of this. He's that one guy from The Outer Limits.
He's that one guy from Highlander 2.
He's that one guy from the new Batman Adventures.
He's that one guy from JoJo Dancer, Your Life is Calling. Remember that?
That doesn't really exist.
Yes.
Well, he's that one guy from FX, the series.
He's that one guy from Prom Night 2.